This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Welcome. My name is Stan Rosenfeld. You've been hearing great information from all the doctors. Now we get personal. So let's get on with it. Let me see if I do the slides right. So prostate cancer is a couple's disease. You probably heard this before. I could probably say this about any disease when there's a couple involved. Both members of the couple are affected in very similar ways. All right, so not a lot of research on the effect on the partner of the disease, in this case, prostate cancer. So we hope to share some of that experience with you today with our panel. And on our panel, in front of you, the seven courageous men and women, and doctor here, which we'll introduce in a second, and we sincerely thank them. Thank you all. And here's our panel, Fred and Ethan. I'm just showing next to the people. This is Dr. Fred Fox, MD, and Ethan, his partner, and I'm just showing what the treatments they've had. Fred and Ethan, if you just raise your hand so people know, so they can call on you later if they have specific questions. And Greg and Sherry, great. And Gary and Beverly, terrific. And Stacy and Patty, there are couples who've been through this. I will point out, I have this note next to Gary, that besides the ADT and radiation, he's still having problems. He's probably ADT resistant. And by now, you know what ADT resistant means. So how did you handle, this is our first question, how did you handle the initial diagnosis of prostate cancer? And Gary and Beverly are going to talk about shared decision making. Gary or Beverly? Gary?
Initially, when I first got the diagnosis, I did not handle it well at all. And part of that was that I did not really include my wife in anything. She may remember it differently. We both went to the same doctor's appointments and all that. But when it came down to making a decision, I had been recommended to have surgery. And I was read something and I became terrified by it. I've since found out that I had no reason to be terrified by what I saw, but I didn't really include my wife in my thinking very much at all, and that was a big mistake. The other thing was that I didn't have a support group, which I really wish I'd had. So,
okay, thank you very much. Anything else from anybody?
That's on. Okay.
Beverly, sure.
Yeah, I hear it. So we knew that he was going to have a biopsy ahead of time, and I looked up a lot of stuff. So I did a lot of research, probably when he was not aware of that I was doing that much research, because I had just retired in June. He had his treatment in December of that year. So he was diagnosed about September or October. I remember I was taking a class and I was not sure if I was going to be able to fit in the final exam. I kind of told him, well, it's your body and you can decide. But one reason I did that was because of the two choices we narrowed it down to, sort of. There was only a 1% difference in the 10-year outcome. And I figured if he really didn't want the surgery, then go ahead with the radiation. He went EBRT at that time. Some of that has improved quite a bit, I think, since then. But it's still, people are still having, going on to having prostate cancer recur, which is what happened to Gary. But what stressed me out at the time was that he was so freaked out when he saw a picture of the prostatectomy online, and it really sort of almost eliminated that possibility ahead of time without really considering it. But we did go to the person who would have done the surgery and talked about it, and went from there and talked to Seeds and also EBRT. And I think there was another thing we looked at the time. And so it took us over a month to finally come up with what we were going to do. Okay. And but I in the end, I told him, you know, you decide. I didn't tell him what I felt about which one to pick, because I figured it was his body. But maybe he would have liked me to have said, I don't know, at this point. Since it recurred, he has sometimes different feelings about whether he should have chosen surgery instead of EBRT, I think.
Thank you, Beverly. Thank you, Gary. And I forgot to introduce Dr. Benjamin Breyer. I realize now, chair of the urology department. Benjamin. All right. Thank you, guys. So now, how do you handle low or no libido? Fred and then Patty. Fred.
Yeah. So low libido. I married Ethan Barnes, or was together with Ethan Barnes before this happened. And Ethan is 31. I'm 77. That was now 4 years ago. And that was quite a whopper, because I was quite sexually active and engaged. And the combo of the surgery and then ADT, androgen deprivation, with a non-existent testosterone and irradiation and its side effects were just, I wouldn't say devastating, but certainly remarkable in my life. And I must say that love conquers all. And in a very loving relationship, I was able to survive quite okay. And it's not been simple, but it's definitely gotten a whole lot better. So, yeah.
Thank you, Red.
How did you handle your low libido?
Oh my, maybe you can answer that.
Well, you know, things definitely changed. Like our first year together, it was great. And then all of a sudden prostate cancer hit and I didn't know what to expect, and neither of us did, but we sort of had to go through it like everybody else. So we did what we could when we could. And the low libido, sometimes you just don't feel like playing or anything, and so it did slow down, but we still found ways to interact in that way by just being creative.
Good. Thank you, Fred and Eve. And Patty.
Well, prostate cancer made me realize the penis is just another muscle. Is that right? Is it a muscle? Well, an organ. But it's like a muscle in that if you don't use it, you lose it. So what I learned was, even though Stan had no libido, I would encourage him to get erect. And we'll talk about how we did that later on the erectile dysfunction slide. But with the low libido, I thought it was my job to remind him, it's been a while, you've got to get hard. It's been a while, you've got to use it or lose it. So that was my role, was like a cheerleader who participated in the sport.
Yeah. Similarly,
Patty would say to me, it's time to fool around, Stan. Thank you, Patty. All right. What's most important to you in a loving relationship? And Ethan.
Yeah, sure. Just piggybacking on where we were. It was more important that I was there with him in his journey through prostate cancer. And unlike other relationships here on our panel, like, he's a doctor. He's smart. I knew he would make the right decisions for himself. He keeps up with his medical journal. And so I didn't feel like I needed to interject my opinions of what treatment he should get. So I was there more or less to be a support role. And for other relationships, I'm sure there are different ways you do that. And like Patty, I would encourage Fred to, you know, watch sexual activity, and that sometimes would help him get going. And so I guess, yes, the prostate cancer is devastating to our sexual health, but we sort of just, we found, we have a much larger collection of toys now. So, and that came through the process of prostate cancer, because, you know, you lose some things, you have to supplement. And our roles might have changed in the way we play in the bedroom quite a bit. So, you know, we're waiting for, I'm waiting for the day that things can go back and forth to how we enjoyed in our first year. But I mean, even the medicine, as we have, as you've seen in certain slides, they affect his body. Like when we met, he had a rockin' body, and then the medicine just really devastates you. So as his loving partner, I know I'm not going to maybe pick on him for those reasons, like, oh, you're looking a little heavier now. Like, it's not his diet necessarily. It's a lot of the medication, and he works out and keeps himself fit. So I don't know. I think that's really important to us, to just maintain our mental health, and that will lead to a better sexual health.
Thank you. That's
great. I want to chime in.
Go ahead, Patty.
I just want to say, in addition to what goes on in the bedroom, what's most important to me in a loving relationship is having Stan here. So no matter what it takes to keep him healthy and alive, that's most important. And in the process, we have to have fun. So companionship, movies, Scrabble, hiking until I got multiple sclerosis, and I can't do that anymore. But I still cheer on Stan, who plays pickleball every day, and we look for things we can do together, which is sometimes over a board game and sometimes in a theater, and most of all with our friends. But to me, the most important thing is that he's here, and I'll do anything I can to keep him here as long as I can.
Thank you, Patty. That's great. Thank you.
All right. Oh, so we're back to Patty, who's going to tell you her part of how we handle erectile dysfunction, keeping in mind that people who've had radical prostatectomy have erectile dysfunction, people who had radiation therapy have erectile dysfunction, and people on androgen deprivation therapy often, most often, have erectile dysfunction. So, Patty, what did we do?
Well, there was the pump, and then there were injections. So when it was time to fool around, I would say, Stan, it's time to pump up or shoot up. Some couples say put up or shut up. I said shoot up or pump up. And we tried to make it fun. And when people ask me, did I miss the spontaneity? I reminded them that when I was younger, much younger, it was never spontaneous, because women often had to stop to put in a diaphragm, or they had to stop to get a condom. So we just pretended we were young again, and the interruption was just a normal part of being intimate. So instead of me stopping to do what I had to do, we stopped to do what he had to do. But we did it together. I never let him help me put my diaphragm in, but I didn't have to, because he had a vasectomy before I met him. But before I met him, putting in a diaphragm with other partners years ago, we've been married 35 years, but before that, there were partners who had to deal with interruptions before you could be intimate. So most men, I think, if they started young enough, have had that experience already. So pumping up and shooting up wasn't too much of an interruption. It wasn't much of an inconvenience. Again, it was use it or lose it, and that's how we used it.
Thank you so much, Patty. All right. Brain fog, Beverly and Gary.
Yeah. I had EBRT, and that lasted about 8 years. And then my PSA started going up. And so I went on intermittent Lupron. meaning, you know, you're on it for 3-4 months, 3 months, and then you go off it for a period of time. When I started, the brain fog was worst when I first started the Lupron, and it would get less when I was off it. In other words, when I was on a, what they call it, a holiday, you know, not having Lupron shots. I thought I should describe what it was for me, which is that I just couldn't think. It would be like, you know, I all of a sudden my brain shuts down and I can't think. I remained able to drive, but I was driving very slowly. And because I was concerned about it. I know someone who actually had got to the point that he couldn't read. I didn't get to that point, but mainly it was just, I simply wasn't as alert. It's gotten better as time has gone on, and I've never heard anybody else say that.
Great. Beverly, you wanted to add something? Yes.
Well, what I was noticing at the very beginning was when we drive and he'd get to a stop sign, he'd take like a second longer to start again. And when I'd ask him a question, it'd take him a little bit longer to answer. What's surprising to me now is maybe I got used to how he was then. I don't know. But even though now he's on Lupron all the time and has added abiraterone and the other med that you go with that, prednisone, it seems like he's more able to do things. I mean, his driving, I know, you know, although he gets tired. So that's another issue. But when he drives in the morning, it's like normal. I don't notice any difference. What happens in the afternoon is another issue. I wind up driving home a lot of times instead of having him drive because he feels like he can't stay awake enough to do it. And that's a little different from the brain fog. What was worrisome is, I said, he's at risk for dementia. He just took a dementia test and passed fine. So now I don't have to worry about that again. But he had had a brain scan a while back, and they said, oh, you're never going to have dementia because your brain looks like younger than what you are. But so anyway, that was a little bit of a scare. But I think for the most part, the brain fog, maybe you can, the exercise that he does helps get rid of some of the effects of the brain fog. Something's going on where he's just not as out of it as he was when he first was on Lupron, which is kind of nice.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And urinary incontinence, Patty?
So being a woman, I had the advantage of knowing about Kegels. So I encouraged Stan to do Kegel exercises. And also I encouraged him to see a pelvic floor specialist, which is different from a urologist, even though a lot of urologists do both. There are specialists in pelvic floor strength, and that helped. And also, this may be my brain fog or my poor memory. I hardly remember. He had incontinence, but I don't really remember a lot about that being the major issue.
Yeah, it came and went rather quickly.
What was more disturbing to me was when you had to wear that bag. What's that called when the urine goes in a bag after surgery?
When you have the catheter?
The catheter.
Yeah.
Having the catheter in right after surgery was a lot more disturbing to me than the incontinence afterwards, because I knew it was temporary and there were pads for it and it didn't really interrupt our lifestyle that much.
I will mention that in 1998, when I had my surgery, the catheter was kept in for 3 weeks, 21 days. Now it's like 7 days. So that was a way longer, Patty.
This was short of the time.
All right, rectal bother, Fred, you're going to talk about lidocaine and patients and Fred.
So after my prostatectomy, shortly after my prostatectomy, within 6 months, my PSA began to rise again. I had had a positive margin. I had an aggressive tumor, grade 9. I had a very high Decipher score, all of which made that perhaps predictable. But the irradiation really caused a lot of GI discomfort, going to the bathroom, number two, and a lot of pain. And it took quite a long time for it to resolve. I had rather extensive irradiation because of the aggressiveness of the tumor. And so it was just really, really uncomfortable and precluded some things that were quite normal in our past loving relationship. So it was more than a bother, I would say. Topical lidocaine around the anus, making sure I wasn't ever constipated, helped, but it really was quite a long siege, many, many months, probably more than a year, actually more than a year, before it became less, if not altogether, unnoticeable.
Thank you, Fred. All right, so fatigue is a problem with various treatments. Patty, you were going to say something about fatigue.
So this is one of the most surprising and paradoxical things I learned. The more tired you are, the more effective exercise is to beat the fatigue. So even though you don't feel like doing it, forcing yourself to do it or having a loving cheerleading partner telling you to do it really helps. So I would encourage Stan to keep moving and keep active. And he played tennis then. Now he plays pickleball. But then he played tennis. And I made sure that he had a tennis date almost every day so he could keep playing tennis and keep moving. And we would go on hikes and I would force him to go a little further. Now it's reversed. Now he forces me to go further than I want. Back then I would force him to go further than he wanted and make sure he got exercise, because his fatigue levels really were reduced the more he exercised. So if you can live with paradox, that's a good one.
Right. Thank you, Patty. And that's been shown in studies with large numbers of men. Anybody else want to say anything about fatigue? We have an extra minute or two. Okay. So, whoops. Oh, what happened there? Oh, wait a second. Okay, here we go. That's interesting. Pushed the wrong button. Okay, so climacteria is the loss of urine during orgasm, and both Ethan and Patty have something to say. Ethan?
Yeah, I think we touched on that a little earlier, right?
Okay.
But I, for us, you know, that I think affected us a little bit more than it might affect other couples when it came to oral play. We had to really lay down a lot more pads because there's more fluids involved, and you know, it can be shocking to try new things, sort of, and I'm sure a lot of people would be put off by climacteria if you don't enjoy that body fluid. And you know, it kind of just made its way into our sexual experience without asking. And so we sort of just had to deal with it and still make it fun and not just be so shut off from it that, you know, we lose what little libido we had to work with.
Thank you, Ethan. Patty?
I also encourage Stan to use the bathroom and empty his bladder before we get intimate and try to make sure it's as empty as possible before he climaxes.
Thank you, Patty. All right, lack of ejaculate. Sherry?
Well, our experience, is this on? Okay. Our experience happened before we knew he had prostate cancer. He had a TURP surgery, which is where they remove some of the prostate, or ream you out, as he would say, and that would help with urination because he was getting UTIs and that kind of thing. And so while they had the tissue out, they looked at it under the scope, and then they found the slow-growing prostate cancer. That was 2015. Hmm. And so after that surgery, there was no ejaculation. And that was weird. I mean, it was strange. I wasn't expecting it. I don't think anybody mentioned that that would be a thing. But it didn't, it was, I mean, for me, a bonus. So it didn't really bother me as a spouse. I don't think he cared. No.
Okay. Thank you. Ethan wants to say something. Thank you, Sherry.
I think when we talked about this as a group, we wanted to bring up the fact that it may affect younger couples more. And you talk in your group about freezing sperm for future use.
Yeah, very right. Good. Doctors, RO, all the doctors I know here at UCSF tell men who aren't going to have ejaculate for any reason that freezing sperm is an option if they want to have children. Thank you. I was going to say something about lack of ejaculate. I just want to say my personal experience and all the men in my support group's personal experience is they notice something the first 2-3 times, like what's missing, and then they forget about it. I mean, by, you know, the fifth orgasm, it's the orgasm you concentrate on, you forget about the lack of the ejaculate. I mean, and then a year after and 2 years after, it's like a memory. All right. Whoops, there I go. Wrong button. What button is that? That's that button. I see. All right. Oh, wait, we're not there yet. Sherry is going to tell us again some other ways of showing and expressing love and giving pleasure.
So we're still kind of new into this. Just a year ago, he had his prostate removed. And since then, you know, he has the ED and, you know, trying to get over the incontinence, which takes time. So we're still kind of new at that. So we're kind of bumbling through this together, but we do everything together. And I think that that's important. We enjoy each other. We enjoy being with each other. And we talk all the time. We have happy hour on the patio. We watch movies at night, just whatever. And so while, you know, we hopefully will be able to have like a normal, I don't know that we'll ever have a normal sex life again, but we have intimacy in other ways, like just, you know, being very close and honest with each other and loving, and we respect each other. We, you know, I too want to keep him around. So I'll do whatever it takes to, you know, make sure that he's well as much as I can control it. So.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ethan.
So again, we just really enjoy being with each other, and our experience, like Sherry said, is kind of different because I was diagnosed initially with that low-grade, slow-growing prostate cancer and was just on active surveillance. And then fast forward to the pandemic, I, you know, stopped going in for my PSA tests and digital rectal exams. And then in January 2021, I was diagnosed with a rare non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So 2021 was all about 7 hospital stays, 40 plus days in the hospital, 5 rounds of chemo, a stem cell transplant. And so we really, that's when the major impact happened to our sex life. And then maybe a year or so after that was over, I thought, yeah, geez, I should really get my PSA tested again. We've kind of been focused on the lymphoma and had kind of put the prostate cancer on the back burner. And so I went in and it had risen. And then I, you know, had a biopsy and it said it was Gleason 7 and ended up having surgery. And it turned out it was Gleason 9. And so it's kind of been this whole cascade of events. But I guess the thing for me is, you know, yes, sex was the icing on the cake in our relationship, but even without the icing, we still have the cake. And so it's been,
that's great.
You know, she is just so awesome in so many ways and so supportive. And I just like to say that she's been my angel through all of this. And I don't know how I would have made it through this without her.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you so much.
Can I add something?
Yes, Penny.
Stan likes kissing more than I do, and I like hugging more than he does. So we make a very happy compromise. When we pass each other in the hall, if he wants a kiss, I get a hug, and if I want a hug, he gets a kiss. And we do that throughout the day.
Thank you so much. All right. So now the time has come for to go down the line, and you're each going to tell for, I don't know, 30 seconds or something like that, your take-home message to the group that's here, and it's going to go out to, I don't know how many tens of thousands of people. So don't be shy. Let's start with Dr. Fred and tell us your take-home message.
My take-home message is communication and being in the most loving relationship you could imagine. I have that.
Good, thank you. And Ethan?
So marry well, that's what you're saying. Well, as the healthy one of our relationship, sticking with my theme, I think it's really important to take care of our sick partner, in a sense, to mitigate any sort of effects. And sort of touching back on the last slide, showing love to our partner in new and different ways. When we're in bed and, you know, my libido's high, you know, we'll take care of it and he'll enjoy being there, you know? So even if your partner's not always in the mood, sometimes they just love like being there with you afterwards.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ethan. And Beverly?
There are a lot of activities you can still do together if one of you has got prostate cancer. And we've both found support groups helpful. Especially I had a cascade of things go wrong about a month ago, and I just joined a support group for caregivers of people who have cancer, and that helps too. But the one that Gary's in three of them, I think, that are all talking about different treatments that are done and so forth, and it's a little bit different than support. But it's very helpful to get all the information and kind of know what you're up against, and makes it easier to not have a surprise.
Thank you, Beverly. Gary?
Yeah, the best advice I could give anybody is to find a support group. And when you do that, you want to find a group in which people share their experience and their knowledge. And you know, individuals will talk openly about their personal situation, and other people will come in with their, you know, their similar experiences, their knowledge about treatment and what they've been through. You do not want one in which people try to tell you what to do. If you find somebody trying to say, well, this is what you should do, go find another support group. Yep. Or else just, if you can, ignore that person, but otherwise go find another support group, because what you want is the mutual sharing of experience.
All right. Thank you, that's good. Sherry, please.
I guess my takeaway is that it's important to work together and just be open and honest with each other about everything, researching what you should do, because the information is so overwhelming of what treatment you want or should do, and different doctors have different opinions. So we just put our heads together.
Good, that's wonderful. Gary?
I will say I'm extremely thankful for UCSF. UCSF is an amazing resource. We came to discover it through my lymphoma journey, and you know, then naturally came here for my prostate cancer as well. In my case, I feel like I may be overachieving on the cancer front, and Sherry tells me I really need to get a new hobby, but I just hope that you can find someone like Sherry is for me, who's just been so supportive. I just can't really fathom going through what I've been through in the last few years without my angel beside me. Mm-hmm. So I just hope that you can find someone like that, whether it's a spouse or friend, that can just really be there for you like that.
Beautiful. Thank you. Dr. Benjamin.
Yeah. Well, first off, I want to just say thank you to these couples for sharing their experiences. And it's really powerful. And my practice, so I'm the chair of urology, and benefit from having just incredible colleagues who treat cancer and cure cancer and do their best for cancer. The thing that I do is I help men with sexual and urinary problems after the cancer therapies. And having treated thousands of couples and thousands of patients with these problems, I can tell you that when a couple comes to my office, it's very, very helpful for the patient because they have someone to support them, another set of ears. Often the spouse is taking notes, or the partner is taking notes. And that's incredibly powerful when you're trying to determine what therapy you need or what path to go down, what questions to ask. And, you know, I think the take-home message for me listening to this diverse group here really is there's no one size fits all, and there's many ways to help ameliorate the problem. And having a supporting spouse or partner in the process is really helpful.
Good, thank you. And Patty.
My take-home message is have a gratitude practice and realize everything you have and don't focus on what you don't have. And laughter is really helpful. We make a point of watching funny movies, subscribing to a newspaper called the Funny Times, which is the only paper I like to read cover to cover because it's all cartoons and jokes. It's like a Reader's Digest of last month's cartoons. And laughter and gratitude are, I think, the best recipe for getting through this cancer or anything in life.
Thank you, Patty. And I guess my take-home message is, and repeat what Fred said. You said communicate, and I'm going to say communicate, communicate, communicate.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.